Morning, everyone. Let's start with a meditation. Let's do a short Tonglen meditation to start today. As an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body. Becoming aware of sensations throughout the body. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment, focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now we can begin by using the Tonglen practice to cultivate loving kindness and compassion for ourselves and then expand that out to others. no matter how much mental afflictions we have in our mind, no matter how much craving and jealousy and anger and anxiety and so forth we have in our mind, beneath these mental afflictions is the natural purity of our mind, our Buddha nature, our potential to reach the highest goals imaginable. So imagine this inner purity of your mind in the form of a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of your chest, at the level of your heart. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I were free of suffering and its causes. May I be free of all suffering and mental afflictions. And then imagine your mental afflictions and suffering in the form of black smoke filling your body. And then with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing your mental afflictions and suffering at your heart. And then imagine now the black cloud is completely extinguished, and now you're free of all mental afflictions and suffering. And take delight in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if I had happiness and its causes. May I be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, filling and saturating your entire body and mind, and transforming into everything you need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending to yourself whatever you need to be happy. And then imagine that you've now found the genuine happiness that you seek, and rejoice in this. Now allow your field of loving kindness and compassion expand out to the person seated next to you. They are just like yourself in wanting to be happy and wanting to be free of suffering. So arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they were free of suffering and its causes. May you be free of all mental afflictions and suffering. And then imagine their mental afflictions and suffering in the form of black smoke filling their body. And with each in-breath, imagine drawing that black smoke out of their body and bringing it into the sphere of light at your heart, completely dissolving it there. So with each in-breath, breathe in with compassion, dissolving and extinguishing their mental afflictions and suffering at your heart. Then imagine the black cloud is now completely extinguished. And now they're free of all mental afflictions and suffering. And take delight in this. And then arouse the thought, how wonderful it would be if they had happiness and its causes. May you be truly well and happy. And then with each out-breath, imagine rays of light radiating out from your heart, filling their body and mind, and transforming into everything they need to be happy. So with each out-breath, breathe out the light of loving kindness, sending to them whatever they need to be happy. And then imagine that they've now found the true happiness that is their heart's desire. And rejoice in this. And then release all appearances and simply allow the mind to come to rest. And simply rest in the experience of awareness itself. Resting in the stillness of awareness. Being aware of being aware. So again, let's start with a short review of what we've covered in this 7-point mind training text before we continue on. So what we've seen so far is that, of course, the first point was the preliminaries. We need to have a good basis, a foundation for the main practice, and we should never underestimate that and never put... We should always put a lot of effort into the preliminary practices, not only in the beginning stages, but then continue to work on the preliminaries or foundations and integrate them into the main practice. Otherwise, our foundation will crumble, and probably we're not going to be able to put any effort into the main practice because we're going to be caught up in chasing after lots of pleasures in life and looking outward. So the main practices, of course, wisdom and compassion. And here in the Mahayana, the wisdom practice, of course, is the emptiness practice, and the compassion practice is the bodhicitta aspect. So we first looked at the wisdom practice. And the wisdom practice, the ultimate bodhicitta, we saw that there are two aspects to this practice, as there are with every practice: the meditation practice, what we do in meditation, and then what we do for the rest of the day, how we integrate that into life. And so emptiness practice has those two aspects of the meditation practice and the daily life practice. And so the meditation practice is often called space-like emptiness practice, and the daily life practice is called illusory-like emptiness practice. So the meditation practice is called space-like practice because in that meditation we are investigating a particular phenomenon, whether it be the person, the mind, or some external phenomena. And we are investigating how does that thing exist. And when we're searching, we're coming to the point of not finding the independent person or the independent mind or whatever we're looking at. And so that not finding, of course, is a space-like experience. So hence it's called space-like practice. We are resting in that state of not finding, which is a space-like experience, realizing that that object that we looked for is not findable. It does not inherently exist. It does not independently exist. And what we said was that often in the classic approach here, when we begin our emptiness practice, we begin by focusing on ourselves as a person. Where is the me that seems to be here? There really does seem to be a me here, existing from its own side, existing independently of everything else. And then we search for this me here. In the Lojong, or the mind training here, it went through slightly different sequence. It first started by saying, train to view all phenomena as dreamlike. And that is to look at perceived objects, to see that the phenomena we perceive are mere appearances. They're not existing as a separate reality from the mind. And then the second slogan was to turn our attention to the mind itself. Examine the nature of the unborn awareness. So the mind to which all of these appearances appear, what about that? Is that really existing independently or not? And we can come to realize that it's unborn, meaning primordially unproduced, not inherently produced, does not inherently exist. And so this approach is very similar to often the approach we see in the Kagyu and Nyingma school, particularly in the Kagyu, in the Mahamudra approach, by focusing on the nature of the mind. And here there are four very nice statements that I'd just like to mention that sort of reflect a little bit what's being said here in the mind training, the Lojong. So this is coming from the Mahamudra system of practice within the Kagyu tradition, and this is one approach to the Vipassana practice, to come to realize the nature of the mind. And like here in the mind training, the first stage is to see that all appearances are mind. Meaning to come, as it says here, to see all phenomena as dreamlike, that they're mere appearances, that there is none of these objects that appear to the mind are existing in a reality separate from the mind, that they are, all appearances are mind. And then in the second stage, like here, turn the attention to the mind itself. To realize that the mind is empty, that there is no independently existent mind. But that fact that the mind is empty of independent existence doesn't mean that nothing really exists. Because of the empty nature of the mind, then things can appear. And so the third realization is what's called emptiness is spontaneous presence. That because things are empty, particularly the mind is empty, therefore things can appear. There is this what's called spontaneous presence due to that fact. And we often hear poetically that things arise out of emptiness. And because we understand that things are arising out of emptiness, that leads to the fourth realization. What's called spontaneous presence is self-liberating. That because we understand that these appearances have the very nature of emptiness, they are arising out of emptiness, then they are self-liberating, which means that there's no grasping to them. So they liberate themselves, no grasping. So this is often how this is something similar to what we see in the Lojong is explained in the Mahamudra system. So I particularly like these four statements. They really help us to appreciate the idea of emptiness and dependent arising. So that was just a little side point.
What is the Mahamudra?
It's the system of practice in the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism. Mahamudra, Maha is great, mudra means seal, great seal. So it's really talking about nature of the mind practice. Very similar to the system of practice in the Nyingma school called Dzogchen. This is also nature of the mind practice. And then we saw in the Ultimate Bodhicitta here in the Lojong that in daily life we are to practice this illusory-like emptiness practice, to be a conjurer of illusions, meaning to not automatically accept appearances on face value, to question appearances. Again, particularly useful when we're caught up in pleasant and unpleasant experiences, is to look for the pleasantness or unpleasantness in the object, or to look for the me who is about to get caught up in craving or aversion or so forth. And then now we looked at conventional bodhicitta. And here, in conventional bodhicitta, the method that we were using to cultivate bodhicitta was this exchanging self with others. The most common technique, of course, was the seven cause and effect. But here we are using this exchanging self with others approach. Very powerful approach to exchange self-cherishing with a mind of cherishing others. And we saw there that in this practice, the meditation practice for exchanging self with others is this Tong Len practice. And so we explained that, and we've now done a couple of Tong Len meditations. And then in daily life, what we saw there in terms of the two slogans, one was to the three objects, the three poisons, three roots of virtue, which was to say that to use this sort of Tong Len or exchanging self with others in daily life when we ourselves are starting to get caught up in mental afflictions. But also we can use this in terms of our own suffering. So whenever we see ourselves caught up in any mental affliction or suffering, then we can use this approach. Instead of simply getting caught up in our mental afflictions and suffering and developing aversion to that and magnifying the suffering, we can understand there must be infinite number of people who have similar mental afflictions or suffering at the moment. So then we can take on all of that and give them happiness. So we can use that, our own suffering or mental afflictions, and transform them into loving kindness and compassion by reflecting on others. And of course, also we can use this practice in daily life when we see others suffering. If someone else has some obvious physical or mental suffering, then we can do this with one breath. It's simply on the in-breath, take their suffering, on the out-breath, give them happiness. So we can, throughout the day, whenever we see anyone suffering, physically or mentally, we can do this exercise. So we have plenty of opportunity throughout the day to really cultivate this mind of exchanging self with others. One other situation I think can be very helpful to use this approach in daily life, and that is when we're about to enter into some difficult situation in our life. Maybe we're going to meet our boss at work and we anticipate it's not going to go very well, or we're about to meet someone who we feel we're going to get very upset with and maybe react to them. Then usually when we're entering into these difficult situations, already we're on the defensive. And if we're on the defensive, then often what happens is as soon as they say some little thing, we react. So, and it usually doesn't go very well then. So rather than that, we can do this practice here. As we're actually physically approaching this person, and before we open our mouth, then we can do this practice. We can take their mental afflictions and suffering and give them happiness. In that way, we won't be defensive, in a more positive state of mind, and therefore more likely to respond in a constructive way than to react in a negative way. So this also can be very helpful use of this practice in daily life. And so that was then the conventional bodhicitta. And now we are on point three of the 7 points, and that is taking adverse conditions onto the path of enlightenment. So one of the great strengths in Lojong, or mind training system of practice, is this ability. Because in general, in spiritual practice, we would like to have conducive, good conditions to practice. And when we're faced with adverse conditions, then it makes it difficult for us to practice. And of course, in our modern society, we often are faced with a lot of difficult situations. And that seems to be a problem or obstacle to our practice. But here, in Lojong, or mind training, we have these slogans here that can help us to also see difficult or adverse conditions as conducive conditions to practice. And there are two outlines there on how to do that. The first one is how to take these adverse conditions into the path using bodhicitta, both the conventional and ultimate. And the second part is then this practice of what's called accumulation and purification, and we'll look at that a little bit later. So at the moment we're in the first part, and that is how to take adverse conditions into the path on the basis of conventional bodhicitta, this mind of exchanging self with others. And here, the whole way of being able to do this is to be able to correctly distinguish between friend and enemy. Because now, we don't clearly distinguish who or what is our friend and who or what is our enemy. We often feel that this self-cherishing mind is our friend, bringing us happiness. And we often feel other people are the enemy. They're the ones that are causing me suffering. So we see our own self-cherishing as the friend and others as the enemy. And of course, as long as we have this mistaken view, then of course we're not going to be able to take adverse conditions into the path. We're simply going to react to those adverse conditions because we're going to believe that those adverse conditions are actually the source of our suffering. And we're going to have aversion to it and try and get rid of it and react to it. And then, of course, the more that we get caught up in seeing ourselves cherishing as our friend, the more suffering we're going to induce on ourselves as well. So here, then, we're looking at the first part of that, and that is to recognize your own self as the enemy. To really recognize that the self-cherishing mind is our enemy and others are our friend. And if we can make that shift and see the self-cherishing as the enemy and others as the friend, then we're going to be able to take difficult situations into the path. And the first slogan we were looking at there is, banish all blames to a single source. And of course, the single source of all suffering is self-cherishing, which of course is based on self-grasping, grasping onto independent me. So here we often see interchangeably these two words, self-grasping, self-cherishing, because one is the basis of the other. So we've looked through a number of points there, and I think we've got to, on page 101, or page 8, in the right-hand column, about halfway down, is where we left off yesterday. So let's continue on there. So just to read the last sentence we covered yesterday, the previous paragraph, in fact, let's read the whole paragraph. It says, contemplate along these lines, and whenever any self-centered thought arises, the master said, and again the master is Chikawa, Geshe Chikawa, you should be cognizant and strike at the snout of this boar with a cane. So again here this analogy is that soon as any self-centered mind is arising, then we are to strike it on the snout with the cane, meaning to not allow it to continue and to grow, but to let go of it immediately, to do something to oppose it and not allow it to take hold of our mind. Therefore, it was taught that as far as the subject matter of all the teachings of the Great Vehicle, the Mahayana, is concerned, there are only two themes: totally let go, letting go of self-grasping, and upholding sentient beings with deep concern. So these are the two aspects of wisdom and compassion. So the wisdom, of course, is the wisdom of emptiness, which is overcoming the self-grasping mind. And then upholding sentient beings with deep concern is the compassion wing of the practice, this exchanging self with others. On this basis, crippling the self-grasping as much as you can and nurturing sentient beings as much as you can. So if we continue on then, a few more things to say in this section before we get to the next part, where we see others as our friend and cherish them. Furthermore, since all the sacred scriptures and treatises were taught for the purpose of subduing the afflictions, it is the afflictions that must be subdued by means of them. In general, there are 84,000 afflictions. We often hear that the Buddha taught 84,000 teachings to overcome these 84,000 afflictions. Sounds like we've got a lot of afflictions, 84,000. All of which, when subsumed, fall into 212 classes. I think even this footnote here says that they couldn't find any reference to these 212 classes anywhere, and I've never heard of this categorization of 212, so it's a little bit of a mystery, but it must be a certain way of classifying mental afflictions. When subsumed, they in turn fall into the class of the 6 root afflictions and the 20 derivative afflictions. So that's what we saw yesterday already, that in Buddhist psychology, the sort of extensive presentation of the mental afflictions is the 6 root mental afflictions and the 20 secondary mental afflictions. So, of course, the 6 root were the 3 poisons of ignorance, attachment, and anger. And then the other 3 were this pride, this puffed up mind, this doubt, and this afflicted view, which can further be divided into 5. These 2 can be further subsumed into the 5 or 3 poisons. So we saw that the 5 poisons were the 3 poisons of ignorance, attachment, and anger, and then they added pride and jealousy. And then, of course, the 3 afflictions, the 3 poisons, the 3 core ones of ignorance, attachment, aversion, or anger. When subsumed further, they are reduced into a single affliction, namely the self-grasping alone. So we saw that even attachment and aversion come out of self-grasping ignorance. And that's sort of highlighted in this diagram called the Bhava Chakra, the Wheel of Life. In fact, there's one on the wall there. I don't know if that one has this the right way of... No, it looks a bit different, that one. But in the middle of that diagram, we have a pig, a rooster, and a snake. And they are, of course, they're in the middle. They're symbolizing the... Because this is symbolizing the wheel of life called samsara. And the root cause is in the middle, and that's the 3 animals. The pig, the rooster, and the snake. And the pig is symbolizing ignorance. The rooster is attachment, and the snake is aversion. And in a more traditional diagram, and I think this is not like that, I can't really see from here, but in the more traditional diagram, you'll see that the pig is grabbing with its mouth the tail of the rooster and the snake to get both of them. Meaning out of the mouth of ignorance comes attachment and aversion. But sometimes it's a little bit hard to draw that, so then they sort of draw that each one is grabbing the tail of the other, which is also okay because... they reinforce each other. But in a more traditional diagram, you'll see that the pig is grabbing both the tail of the rooster and the snake. So if we continue on, it says then, he who has subdued it to the highest degree enjoys the highest degree of happiness, to a medium degree, the medium degree of happiness, and to the minimal degree of happiness. So again, to the extent that we have subdued this self-grasping, this fundamental ignorance, to that degree we will subdue the mental afflictions and suffering. So the root of all suffering is self-grasping. And since all faults and defects are contingent upon this, you must from now on abandon any clinging to your body and mind, and instead regard them as your enemies. So, of course, here we're not regarding the body and the mind as the enemy, but the clinging to the body and the mind is the enemy. Most importantly, you must abandon clinging to the body. And this is something, I'd just like to briefly mention something here, where often people get into some difficulty in their practice. And I've sort of touched on this a little bit already in another context, is that we identify ourselves on the basis of our body and mind. And we say, this is me. This is me. So our sense of identity is often based on a solid sense of body. Me. 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 And also, our sense of me or self is constantly reinforced by mental activity. Our thoughts, our memories, our emotions, our thinking. All of this is constantly reinforcing the sense of me. So both a solid sense of body and all this mental activity is constantly reinforcing a sense of me. And we generally identify ourselves as either as the body or some aspect of the mind. This is me. And this is constantly reinforcing our sense of me. But when we sit down to meditate, particularly initially in the shamatha practice, if we sit down in shamatha and we adopt a good posture and the body becomes very relaxed, then often a solid sense of body is not there anymore. It sort of dissipates. And then, of course, when we are doing the shamatha practice, whether we're focusing on the breath or looking at the mind, or resting in awareness, for that matter, and we're doing the shamatha practice, and then at certain times the mind becomes very quiet and still, no more conceptual activity. But then all of a sudden, there's nothing reinforcing a sense of me. There's no solid body that we're sensing anymore because it's very relaxed. And there's no mental activity reinforcing a sense of me. So we end up in this sort of open, spacious, vacuity experience. And then often when people have this experience, they freak out because it feels like they're going out of existence. Because suddenly there's nothing reinforcing a sense of me anymore. And of course, that fear is completely irrational because there's no fear in that, there's nothing to be afraid of in that very open, spacious expanse. Because the only thing that is being threatened is a false sense of me, a false sense of me that's being reinforced by the body and the mental activity. That's dropping away. So if we can understand that, then we will have no fear in that experience. That we'll just understand that the false sense of me that is constantly propped up by a solid sense of body and all this mental activity that we identify with has dissipated. And a similar experience can happen in the Vipassana practice, that we can come to see that there is no independent me there, and this not finding can also, people can develop a lot of fear again, because they misinterpret this experience. So whether it's in a shamatha practice or Vipassana practice, when that solid sense of me dissipates, there's nothing to fear. In fact, if we understand, if we have some good understanding of emptiness, then actually we'll have a lot of joy, because we'll realize that the me that we've been identifying with our entire life, this independent me, simply does not exist. And we'll have a lot of joy because we'll realize that independent me that's the root of all of my mental afflictions and suffering simply doesn't exist. So I think that's something often important, because unfortunately what I see is a lot of people come into meditation practice without much understanding, intellectual understanding. And then when they have these experiences, they don't know how to interpret them correctly, and then they just freak out thinking that they're either doing something wrong in their meditation or they're going out of existence or they don't really exist, and then their whole practice comes to a grinding halt and they have a lot of fear and anxiety about the practice, and then they stop practicing, which is a great shame, because actually they're practicing well, they're just misinterpreting the experience. So I just wanted to mention that, because I talk to quite a number of people who have this sort of experience.
What about not feeling the body when you sit in meditation?
Good, very good. Because the whole idea of a good posture is to forget about the body. So if you have no sense of body, very good. Because then you can just focus on your meditative practice. Very good. Very good. Exactly. And the reason we're scared is, this is me. Because we're so identified with this body, and that's what it says here, most importantly, you must abandon clinging to your body. That's what we identify with very often. This is me. And if that sense of body is not there anymore, we freak out because we think we don't exist anymore. But again, this is a false sense of me. So if we can understand that, then when we don't have a sense of body in meditation, that's actually very good, because then the body's not causing any problems to our meditative practice. We can go into the shamatha vipassana or bodhicitta practice very well, because we can forget about the body. Very good. So again, if we're having this experience, then just to understand that this fear is completely irrational. We are not the body. We either have a body or we are the body. And I think we have a body, so we're not the body. So if we identify ourselves as the body, then of course, if we don't have a sense of body, we're going to freak out because we think we won't exist. But that's a false sense of me. Similarly with the mind, if we think that We are the mind or the thoughts or the emotions. And if they dissipate, if they go quiet, then of course we're going to freak out because the me is no longer there, the false basis of me. So therefore, again, this is completely irrational fear. And so we can just let go of it altogether and actually understand that actually our practice is going well and then just keep going in the practice. Okay, so let's continue on then. On this point, Shanti Deva states, if I am attached to my body, fear arises from even slight dangers. This body that brings so much fear, who would not detest it like an enemy? And then he says, reflect. Although I have striven hard since beginningless time to benefit this body, it is in the nature of a material object, and it feels no joy or pain in relation to any benefit or injury. As for the mind, it is devoid of substantial reality and empty. So again, the mind is not existing independently. It's empty of independent existence. You cannot find the mind. Since what appears conventionally right now comes into being from causes and conditions, it is devoid of self-defining identity. So again, whether it's the body, the mind, or the person, because it arises through causes and conditions, and of course also parts and labeling, then of course it can't exist independently. It has no inherent nature in itself. And that's what's being said here. Furthermore, since the causes and effects cease every moment, there is nothing that is established for it following its origination. So again, here, I think this is a very good way to get into this emptiness practice, is simply through impermanence. The idea that everything's changing moment by moment. Because if we can really appreciate everything's changing moment by moment, then as it says here, there is nothing that is established following its origination. There is no thing there to point to because it's just change. So if we can really realize this impermanence, not only is it going to be very helpful immediately in terms of reducing attachment and aversion, it's going to be a very good basis for coming to realize emptiness because it's very close to emptiness. Therefore, you should think, in the past, I have been preoccupied with worthless, ruinous pursuits. Now I shall regard my own self, self-grasping, self-cherishing, as the enemy, and shall call upon all eight classes of worldly gods, demigods, and demons, and all 80,000 families of obstructive forces to withdraw their support of this self. Train with the thought, be my ally, and help me and here's I think there's a typo error here. There's something not right. I don't know the original Tibetan, but it does. Anyway, I will read it and I'll let you know. Be my ally and help me vanquish this self-grasping. Help make my five aggregates devoid of substantial reality and empty. You can't make them devoid and empty because they already are. So I think the Tibetan must be something like, help make me realize that my aggregates are devoid of substantial reality and empty. So I think there's something missing there. Because you can't make something empty when it's not, if it's not. So you can only help make me realize that the aggregates are devoid of substantial reality and empty. That makes sense. By engaging in these practices, the master entreated, strive to the best of your ability to subdue this grasping demon during your brief life. Shawopa states, so long as we fail to see our own self as the enemy, no one, including our teachers, can save us. If we see it as the enemy, benefits will ensue. So we really need to see this self-grasping and particularly self-cherishing as the enemy. If we don't, then not even our teacher can help us, because as long as we're caught up in self-grasping, self-cherishing, we're going to be producing mental afflictions and suffering. And then nothing what they say is going to help unless we can really realize that these two are the enemy, self-grasping and self-cherishing. So if you view your own self as the enemy, even when harms caused by hosts of non-humans and malevolent elemental spirits befall you, these become harms perpetrated against the enemy. They become aids in your battle against self-grasping. Since they are a powerful army on your side, it is inappropriate to generate anger towards these agents of harm. Rather, you should look on them with joy. So here again is, and this is going to come up a little bit more in a couple of pages' time, is these agents of harm actually are our friend in a number of ways. People or things that try to harm us are our friends, and that's what we're going to see in the next section. One reason that they're our friend, of course, is that they help us to practice patience. Because if everyone is very kind and nice to us, then it's very hard to develop patience. In fact, it reminds me of a story. This whole Lojong approach to practice is brought into Tibet through great Indian master Lama Atisha. And when he came to Tibet, he brought an attendant with him who was a very obnoxious person, very nasty sort of person. And then the Tibetans said to him, "Why do you have this person as attendant, this horrible person as an attendant?" And Lama Atisha replied to the Tibetans, "This person is my most holy teacher." So he specifically picked him to help him to go further in his practice. Because we can, you know, and this is what happens to many people here. You know, many people come to India and they do these sort of courses and, you know, everyone sort of has similar attitude here, so everything's quite easy and nice. And then people spend some time here in India and they think, "Wow, I've really developed and changed a lot. I'm much less angry and agitated. I'm much more kind and generous now than I used to be. Wow, things have really improved a lot." And then as soon as they go home, the whole thing collapses. Because when they go home, it's a different environment, and there not everyone is having a similar way of thinking and kind and compassionate and so forth. People push our buttons and test us, you know, at work, and so then all of a sudden the whole thing collapses. But actually these people back home are our friends, because they're highlighting to us that actually we're not so advanced as we think we are. So they're really highlighting to us that we still have a lot of mental afflictions to work with. So actually they're being very kind to us, because they're highlighting that actually I still have a lot of anger and jealousy and craving to work on. So they're like a messenger to us. And of course, they test us, you know. So we need to be tested occasionally in terms of our progress, so that we can see where we're at in our practice and not delude ourselves and think that we're much more highly advanced than we really are. Of course, at our level, we don't need to go out and search for these sorts of people to test us. We have more than enough people coming our way in our life to test us. But actually, the further we go in practice, the more we will actually have to go and look for these people. Because it's only these people, the ones who really try and harm us, in fact, as we progress in the practice, they are actually of more benefit to us than people who are kind to us. Because as we progress, we need people challenging us and testing us to go further. Because we can't go further if we don't have those challenges. So actually, at a higher level, they're more kind to us than the people who are and more loving and compassionate to us. But at our level, of course, generally we need people to be kind and compassionate to us, because we can't handle these difficulties so much. So for us at our level, it's good to have kind and compassionate people. In fact, I often talk a lot about this idea of sangha, spiritual community. We need these people at our level. We need people who are kind and compassionate and supportive, and to help us to begin to practice. But again, as I said, as we get to a certain higher level, we'll need to actually go out and purposely look for people who challenge us, like Lama Ratisha did with bringing that obnoxious attendant. But let's not jump ahead and do that from the beginning, because we won't be able to handle that. We'll just get overwhelmed. So rather for us, I think at our level, we need to, again, find that sangha, find the nice, kind people, supportive people who can help us to begin to do something. But then, of course, even when we have that, when we do face these difficult people, at least intellectually, if not, if we can't manage it experientially, at least intellectually understand that these, we can learn from these people, we can benefit from them. Whether or not we're able to, well, that'll depend on our level of ability. But this is what's being said here. At some point in the future, the master said, there will emerge a true spiritual practice that can free you from the narrow gorges of adverse conditions. So I think this is what he's talking about here, is at some point in the practice, there will be no such thing as adverse conditions for us, because all of these will be conducive, and particularly the difficult situations will be the most conducive conditions for us at some level, but maybe not quite now. But even now, of course, as best we can take advantage from these difficult situations and learn from them and progress. Because even at our level, if we see them as obstacles or problems, we're simply going to develop aversion and we're just going to magnify our suffering. At that point, you should train in recognizing the recognition of others as friends. In this manner, train now to distinguish between self and others as enemy and friends, respectively. So here again, we see that self-cherishing is the enemy, others are the friend. Occasionally, you should train your mind also by drawing a distinction between enemy and friend, even within yourself. You can give your lay name to your thoughts and actions concerned with the pursuit of your own welfare, and the ordination name. So ordination name is, I think here historically, when, of course, ordination name is when you become a monk or a nun. And also sometimes now in the modern day tradition, when people do the refuge ceremony, they get like a sort of a name, like Tibetan name or something. So you can use that here instead. Your ordination name to your thoughts and actions concerned with the pursuit of others' welfare. Then following the example of the spiritual mentor Ben, so this was, I think, a person who was, I think, a thief or a robber originally, and then he changed his way and then he went into this mind training practice. Correlate your arms left and right to avoidance of non-virtue and adoption of virtuous acts. The spiritual mentor Ben states, I have no other task than to stand guard with a short spear of antidote at the entrance of my mind. When they, the afflictions, are vigilant, I too am vigilant. When they are relaxed, I too am relaxed. Also, you should be vigilant and strike at the snout of each boar with a cane and chase it. So here again, we have the same analogy. Meaning, whenever a mental affliction arises in our mind, be vigilant, be mindful, notice it arising, and strike it, meaning don't allow it to come in the door of the mind and take hold of your mind. That we need to apply an antidote to that mental affliction and not let it take control of our mind. All the sutras and commentarial treatises too demonstrate there is no task other than eliminating self-grasping. These then present the viewing of one's own self as the enemy and the elimination of self-grasping. Because of Shawopa's teachings, the expression, the practice of for smashing the demon's head evolved. quite a strong way of saying the practice for smashing the demon's head. And so the demon, of course, is the self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. So we're smashing that, the self-grasping, self-cherishing mind. Okay. Any questions? Because that finishes now the first part of how to take adverse conditions into the path through the conventional bodhicitta. And the first part, of course, is to recognize that self-cherishing is the enemy. And, of course, self-cherishing is based on the self-grasping mind. So any questions?
what would be the difference between definition for mindfulness and vigilant, if I were to ask?
Again, here I'm not sure what the word, the Tibetan word, is translated here as vigilant, but when in the shamatha practice we have the two tools of mindfulness and introspection. So mindfulness was our ability to hold the object, and again in Sanskrit, smriti, pali, sati, literally means to remember. So mindfulness is remembering the object, holding the object. And then the other tool was this hook, introspection. So introspection was quality control. So introspection is often translated as vigilance. So I'm not sure if that's been the word here that's translated as vigilant. So vigilant, introspection. And sometimes in psychology, there's a similar term called metacognition. Metacognition, monitoring our own processes and so monitoring ourselves. So, but there's another word that sometimes translated as vigilant, which means to be conscientious. You need to apply effort to do it. But here, I'm not sure what the word is being translated. Vigilant. I think probably that it's probably the same word as this introspection, to be mindful of the, well, we can use the word mindful as well, mindfulness, because actually, we talk about these two tools of mindfulness and introspection, but actually what we find is that the more we cultivate mindfulness, the more our ability to introspect automatically improves. And so actually I think you find in the Kagyu tradition, when they talk about the shamatha practice, you never really see this word introspection, because it's an automatic byproduct of mindfulness. So they just talk about strengthening mindfulness. So if we strengthen mindfulness, our ability to introspect and be vigilant automatically improves. So therefore it's not even usually mentioned. What I've seen, at least in the Kagyu tradition, when they talk about shamatha practice, normally they don't even mention this introspection as a separate tool, because it's sort of a byproduct of mindfulness. Any other questions anyone would like? Yeah.
Maybe it's just my line of work or my spiritual level, but I get challenged constantly by many people. I'm a teacher, so I got colleagues, I got the parents. The children are the less problematic, it's more like colleagues. How to do not to over-challenge myself, or how to not to get over-challenged. I don't need to look for people challenging me.
Of course, what we want to do is develop ourselves to a level where this is not a challenge anymore. It's actually we want. So, of course, the long-term strategy is not somehow just to avoid these people as much as we can. I mean, that's never a solution as a long-term strategy. So the long-term strategy, of course, is to develop, reduce our self-cherishing, self-grasping, improve our qualities. That's the long-term strategy. Short-term strategy is to a number of things we can do, of course. One is to, like you said, not unnecessarily go into these difficult situations and to know our limits. You know, if we are in a difficult situation and we see that it's really getting out of control and we're just becoming negative and the other person's becoming negative, then maybe we need to sort of step back from that temporarily and say, okay, let's talk about this later. Because the more that we allow ourselves to get overwhelmed in these negative situations, we're going in the opposite direction. We're now just increasing our habit of reacting. So we don't want to have that, increase the habit of reacting when we're trying to do the exact opposite. So I think part of a short-term strategy is to, if there are these sort of very, typically very heavy negative influences, which can be people or things, that always overwhelm us, then we need to try and sort of give ourselves as much as practically possible some space or distance from those stimulus. Because in the short term, they're just going to make things worse. So, of course, we're not talking about running away as a solution, but an effective short-term strategy sometimes can be give yourself a little bit of space from these heavy negative influences, because otherwise we can't move forward, we're sort of going backwards. Of course, that's not easy to do, but that's, I think, something we can try to do in the short term at least. And then I think also it's very helpful to, with that, is if we're always just focused, if we're always just encountering negative influences, then at some point it gets like, this is just too much. So we need some sort of boost. So therefore, this whole idea of sangha, I think, also very helpful, is to surround yourself also as much as possible with like-minded people so that you can get sort of at least recharge the batteries a little bit through the week. So therefore, it would be helpful, you know, maybe a few times a week after work or something to meet with like-minded people and do a little bit of meditation or discussion so that you sort of draw on them a little bit to get a little bit of energy from them so that you can better cope with these difficult situations. Because if you're sort of on your own, then at some point it's just too much. It's just like constant. And then eventually it'll just drag us down. So that's why we need to balance that a little bit and connect and surround ourselves as much as possible with like-minded people, this idea of sangha, to really help give us some strength as well. So that can also be helpful. So I think these two things, try to avoid as much as possible heavy negative influences, and secondly, surround ourselves as much as possible with like-minded people, the idea of sangha. I think those two can help in the short-term strategy.
Maybe I should specify the challenge a little bit. They're not coming to me and challenge me like, oh, you're doing bad things. But I see how they mess themselves up, especially my colleagues. I see every day how they make themselves unhappy, complaining all day about pupils. And pupils are pretty amazing, and they're complaining about them all day. And this is like challenging me, looking at them and seeing them doing this all day, all day.
Yeah. So again, here, we looked in the Four Immeasurables on compassion. The near enemy is despair. And so, therefore, two things we can do there. One, of course, is bring in wisdom and understand that, you know, there's not a lot I can do to help them at the moment. I mean, I can give them some little advice and guidance and tips about how to not beat themselves so much. So we do what we can to help them. But to understand that often they're very fixed in their view and that we can't do a lot to help them. But at least we can do this Tonglen practice, you know, because often the one of the reasons we get overwhelmed is that when we see that, we don't like to see that. It's our aversion, actually, that often overwhelms us in those situations. You know, we see people suffer. And we go, oh, I don't like to see that. No. But if we do this Tonglen practice, when we see them suffering, take on their suffering, give them happiness, at least we won't have that aversion and then magnify that discomfort we experience from seeing that. So that's the advice we've just seen in the text. So that's something we can do as well. And there was one other point I wanted to mention, but now it slipped my mind. It went. Compassion. The other point is then to reflect, to have a balanced view, is to, yes, they maybe do all these things of beating themselves up, but sometimes obviously they do good things. So to focus on the positive aspects of the people as well, to have a balanced view. So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think from William James, modern day philosopher, what we attend to becomes our reality. If we're always attending to this, this becomes our reality. We see everyone like this. So therefore, it's helpful to, whenever they do a good action, is to rejoice in that, to, you know, that they're not always, I'm sure not, they're not always beating themselves up. Sometimes they do some kind things, I'm sure.
They're doing a lot of good things, but right, then they go into the staff room and then they're, oh, it's so heavy, it's so difficult. And like, yes.
But again, in the staff room, if you find that that is the pervasive atmosphere and you're finding that that's overwhelming you, then get out of the staff room. Don't spend so much time in the staff room. I mean, if you can stay there and then help them to not be like that, great, fantastic, then do that. But if you find that that's just always overwhelming you, that then they're just going blah, 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 it's so too much, then get out of the staff room, go for a walk or go outside or something, you know, don't stay there.
One idea can be to become an inspector, so you can give a lot of advice. Because actually, I was a teacher, they told me when I said, no, you have to be kind with the students, otherwise they won't learn anything. They told me, but are you taking medicine? My colleagues told me so. So I passed the exam and became an inspector, so I can give a class
there. What you can do then in the staff room is you can get all your teacher colleagues to sit down and do a little Tonglen exercise and take the suffering of their school children on and give them happiness. See what happens.
But it also is a question, you know, because sometimes even when you want to give advice, they receive it as someone who's been, you know, condescending.
Yeah, exactly.
So you have to really be wise about it.
Of course.
I mean, it's stuff that
of course.
When you're happy, you know, and you're like, oh, I can help you. They're like, Yeah, right. So for me,
That's skillful means.
Even like, you know, sometimes ask questions and then they kind of like open up and then what you did. And then, and you know,
exactly.
Kind of like
In a way.
Then you won't be, you know, perceived as someone who is like, his head is in his nose and somewhere there. happy all the day, but then,
Yeah, exactly. So that's wisdom, that's skillful means. So we don't force on them, but you could say, you know, do you want to have a little bit of a rest and a break and that? Let's do a little bit of mindfulness now or something.
To my school, I did it with pupils and my head of school wanted me to start it with my colleagues, but I didn't feel ready because teachers are very difficult.
Exactly. So I think the advice is we need to tread carefully, and not, if we push, then they go back off. So skillful means.
Because it's always you know, look at each other in the teacher room. It's like so, and then you examine like where you good and where not. This lesson was good. This lesson. Are you considered to be someone that is popular? You have it everywhere. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, of course.
And instead of looking at the children and what's important to them, sometimes teachers are much more busy with what they need to do and how they need to perceive themselves.
Of course.
So frustrating sometimes.
Yes.
It's good exercise, isn't it?
Definitely. Yeah. Oh my God, practice. Definitely.
Okay. Let's take a tea break, come back at 10:45, and then we'll continue. We'll start the next section.